My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you and conferences like this and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th of 1973, and for that I am eternally grateful. We give our sobriety date in Texas. That's the way we're raised, and that basically is on the premise that if you don't give one, you may not have one. So I don't want anybody going back to Texas and say that kid didn't introduce himself correctly. I want to thank the committee, and in particular Rick and Connie for their gracious love and time and taking care of Sally and I, and it really is such a privilege and an honor to be a part of your conference. I'm almost embarrassed after listening to Mary Ann last night. As of last June the 19th, I've been married to the same lady for 42 years. Somehow it just doesn't seem right. And Mary Ann was talking about St. Louis last night, and it was interesting because I was in St. Louis at that time at Kiel Auditorium when the 20th anniversary of the International of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Sally's father had come in the program in 1952, and we were living in St. Louis at that time. And I remember when he came in 1952, he used to talk to me about being a part of what he thought would go down as the miracle of the century. And I used to laugh and giggle and say to myself, "You old turkey, you needed the miracle of the century the way you drank." You know. But I have really come to believe that you and I are part of what will go down as the miracle of the century. I think we're part of what literally has changed the face of the earth. And when Mary Ann was talking about singleness of purpose last night, that meant a great deal to me. I love to hear that. And if you missed it, there was a great workshop that Sean had today on the nuts and bolts of sobriety. And when I listen to workshops like that, and I listen to people like Sean and to Mary Ann and to the rest of the people that I've heard so far, we're really in good shape. We really are. And my feeling is, and I have heard this from other people, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not being threatened by its failures today, but Alcoholics Anonymous is being threatened by its success. And everybody wants a piece of us right now because we are successful. And I think we have to be very careful with our heritage, because if you don't protect the thing that's protecting you, you can get in big trouble. And so I think singleness of purpose is something that we really have to protect. And I hope that I will talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon tonight. I was very taken when Jason talked today. And whenever I hear the Alateens speak, by and large, they always have that same feeling and the same story about them. I heard him say today he wanted to be a part of, you know, and he didn't feel as good as, and he had that gnawing sensation of inadequacy. And I don't think that that's isolated to our Alateens. I think that's probably a part of all of us. And as I look back and as I think about it, I think probably I was addicted to approval a long time before I was ever addicted to alcohol. And I think when you're addicted to approval and you want to be a part of, you become very easy to manipulate. And you do things that you don't want to do with people that you don't want to be with and places that you really don't want to go. And I don't know about you, after a period of time, when I fueled that with alcohol, I became a second-class citizen doing second-class things in second-class places with second-class people. And the thing that I love about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will be forever grateful, is that for the most part it permits me to be a first-class person doing first-class things in first-class places with first-class people. And that's a sensation that I never had until I was a part of this program. You know, the miracle of sobriety is instant. It was wonderful to watch the countdown and to see the young lady with 4 days. But the miracle of sobriety is instant. And if you're in this room tonight and you have a sobriety date, one day you were a drunk and the next day you were sober. On September the 6th of 1973, I was a drunk. And on September the 7th of 1973, I was sober. So the miracle of sobriety was instant. But recovery takes a long time. And if there is a prayer that I would have for you and a prayer that I have for me, it's that you have a slow recovery. That you have a recovery on a daily basis and a willingness and an honesty and an open-mindedness to just make it better and better and better. I drank in high school and in college and in the service, the big one, the one that Archie Bunker calls the WW2. That was my war. And I remember I had been shipped to a disembarkation point in California. And a couple other fellows and myself were just going to do a 2-day liberty on the weekends over to Hayward, California. And we were going to go over and drink for a couple of days and then get back to the base on Sunday. And they did, and I didn't. I didn't get back until Tuesday. And, you know, the military gets very upset about that. And I remember these shore patrolmen came to the barracks, and they removed me and took me to the provost marshal, and I had been served a captain's mess. And, you know, it was interesting because this very responsible officer was not talking to me about my drinking, but once again, somebody was talking to me about my behavior. You know, people talk to me about my behavior and people talk to me about my attitude a long time before they ever talk to me about my drinking. And it's such a deceptive disease that by the time it deceives you and by the time you deny it, you can look right at it and say, that's not my problem. I used to think that money was my problem. If I had enough money, I wouldn't have the problems that I have. I mean, I don't know about you. My creditors never called and said, Albert, you're drinking too much. You know, mine called and said, would you please send some money? And I want to tell you, sobriety has not altered my thinking all that much. I mean, I'm still tenacious, I'm still compulsive, I'm not moderate about anything. I can still use up a year's supply of anything in a week if you just leave me alone, you know. And I'm fascinated. Sally and I will be going for a ride, and she'll take out one of those little bag of M&Ms, and she'll tear off the corner, and she'll have two of those and put the rest in her purse. Drives me crazy. I'm alcoholic, and when the lid comes off, it's mine. Sally still hates to send me to the grocery store for a quart of milk, because depending upon where it's located in the store, it can cost anywhere from $5 to $50. I'm an alcoholic that can't get empty carts up and down the aisles without putting things in there. And you don't understand, but pan hangers and super glue and light bulbs are very important to me. And God forbid you should come to my house and want super glue and I don't have it. You know, that drives me crazy. And there has to be an advertising executive in New York somewhere that says, if you want to sell every alcoholic in America something, just put new and improved on it. Because if it says new and improved, you don't have one of them. You got to have it. That or extra strength, you know. That's it. I just want you to know that I need you more tonight than I did the day I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not much of a gamble when you don't have anything to lose. But as I stand here tonight in your presence and privileged to be with you and the love of my wife and my family and my friends, I have a great deal to lose. I got out of the service and back to the University of Iowa in the fall of 1946. In the January of 1947, I walked into a little Iowa tavern. And I saw the lady to my left. And if those of you weren't here today to listen to Sally, I'd like for you to see a very strong Al-Anon, a lady that's stronger than she looks, my wife Sally. And it was interesting because I was with a fraternity brother of mine, and the Betas and the Thetas were having a beer party that night. And I remember I was looking right at her, much like I'm looking at Kim right now. And Sally was absolutely the... See? I caught her napping, you know that? And Sally was absolutely the most beautiful, stunning woman that I had ever seen. And in true alcoholic fashion, I remember looking at her and saying, that should be mine. Now, you know how alcoholics are. We don't court anything. We just capture it. And somehow I had the feeling if I could capture the queen, it would make me a king. If I could put her under glass, you would think I was nice. And somehow I got her telephone number. I can't remember how. But in true alcoholic fashion, I just courted her around the clock for 3 weeks. And one day I got drunk and I cashed in all of my war bonds and I bought a diamond ring. And I remember calling Sally at the dorm and saying, could you meet me outside before the dorm closes? And she said, sure. And I was so drunk that I could hardly get the car parked. Sally came out, got in the front seat of the car. I put the ring on the wrong finger and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life? And she said, yes. We are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And we had talked about my drinking. And I said, when we're married, I won't drink that way. When we have children, when we buy the house, when I have the good job. And I really meant that. I really did. With every fiber of my being, I just didn't know that I couldn't do anything about it. That I had an illness and a disease called alcoholism. Because our particular disease has no scar tissue to it. You cannot see the illness. It shows up in things like letters of reprimand and dishonorable discharge and driving while intoxicated or insufficient funds. But the truth of the matter is, you cannot see our disease when you're looking in the mirror. An interesting thing happened when Sally and I got married. That addiction to approval that I had as an individual, we took on as a couple. We wanted so desperately to be accepted by you in society. And I remember that our parents helped us buy this little GI house. And on weekends, we would drive around the neighborhoods and look at the houses that we couldn't afford. And one day, we saw a house with a red door and a brass kick plate, and we went home, painted our door red, and put on a brass kick plate. And a few weeks later, we drove around another neighborhood, and we saw black shutters, and we loved the looks of that. We went home, bought black shutters, and put them on our house. And then we looked at your shrubbery, and we bought shrubbery that looked like your shrubbery. Because we knew one day you would drive by our house and nudge each other and say, man, that's a good-looking house. And it should be. Looks just like yours. And the trap that we fell into from the very beginning was we thought if we looked good on the outside, you would think we were okay on the inside. And we started having children. Somehow God's most precious gift has turned over to rank amateurs. And I don't know, we did not have a manual on children or a book on kids. We just started having them, and we have a daughter, and we have three sons. And I was working for a large corporation called Owens Corning Fiberglass. For the most part, my career has been with large corporations. And I had received a nice promotion to go to New York, and I remember that Sally and myself and the four children got in the car, and we had driven to New York. And Sally had taken the children and gone up to Connecticut and found a lovely home up in Westport that was built by an old sea captain in 1812. And I had gone to my offices at 56th and 5th in the Glass Building in New York. And if you had stopped me on the street and had said to me, "Albert, how are things going in your life?" I would have said, "Great. Just, you know, you just can't believe how good it is. I have this marvelous job and this beautiful wife and these four children and this home in Connecticut." And you know, when I looked you in the eye, I really meant that, because I did all of the things that society had asked of me, and it should have been okay. Yet somehow I knew that I was dying on the inside. I think every alcoholic knows what it is to die while you're living, and it's a horrible sensation. And I just didn't know what it was. And I used to commute into the city, and sometimes I would come home drunk, and sometimes I would come home sober, and sometimes I wouldn't come home at all, because we used to maintain suites in New York, and if it was more convenient for me, I would stay in the city. And I remember one Friday evening, I came home on the New Haven, and I had been drinking on the bar car, and I kind of fell off the train and got into my car and drove home. And as I came through the back door, Sally started to make some comment about my condition. And whenever Sally would begin to close in on me and start to make a comment about my condition, I would always go into my alcoholic defense routine, which was one-line sarcasm. And God, I loved one-line sarcasm. I could just sting you with it and back you up, and it didn't create any black and blue marks, and it didn't draw any blood, and I could deny it. And usually Sally would always react the same way. And I can't remember what she said that night, but I remember what I said must have been strong enough to back her up, because her shoulders just raised, and she would always say the same thing to me. She would say to me, "Do you mean that?" And I would say, "Do I mean what?" And she would say, "What you just said." "What did I just say?" "Well, you know what you said." "No, I don't. Tell me what you think you thought you heard." And then, God, she would tell me what she thought she heard, and then I could really go into my alcoholic routine, and I would go, "Oh, God, you took that all wrong." I did not use that tone of voice. I did not say it like that. And if I could get her to talk to me long enough, invariably she would always say to me, "Albert, I'm really sorry for misunderstanding." Now, the insanity of that we talk about in step two is that Sally and I didn't do that once in a while. We did that week after week, month after month, year after year. I had been traveling in Texas, and I'd been gone for about 2 weeks, and once again I flew to New York, and I was drunk, and I had leased a car and driven up to our home in Connecticut. And as I came through the back door, this pretty lady that had come up to me so many times and talked to me about my condition just walked up to me that evening. And there was a different look about her, and there was a different carriage about her. And I remember I was waiting for her to say something, and she didn't. And then all of a sudden she said to me, "I would rather be dead than live the way we're living." And I remember that I tried to get my arms around Sally that night, and she said no. And then I said to her, "Let's get some sleep. It'll look better in the morning." And on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, the only lady that I have ever loved said to me, "I would rather be dead than live the way we're living." And she took a razor blade that was sitting on top of the dresser, and she headed for the master bath. And she was talking about slicing her wrists and killing herself. And I remember that I began to yell, and the intensity and volume of my voice, and I could hear myself screaming, "My God, Sally, don't kill yourself. Don't slice your wrists. If my drinking bothers you that much, I'll stop." And the four kids that I mentioned were standing right behind me as I was yelling at their mother, "Please don't slice your wrists." And Sally and I have been privileged to work with the Alateens, and we've sponsored Alateen groups, and we've gone to Alateen conferences. And I want to tell you something. The Alateens and the young people of this program have a different look and a different dimension to the recovery of the illness of alcoholism. I was working with a young guy by the name of Jack, and he was in a very bad situation and getting beaten up regularly on a regular basis. And one night he called me, and I remember Jack said to me, "Mr. Myers, I'm going to kill myself." And I said, "Hey, Jack, don't do that, partner. Just hang on, and I'll pick you up in the morning, and we'll figure something out." And I remember I picked Jack up the following morning, and when he got in my car, I remember saying to him, "Jack, how are things at your house?" And he turned to me and he said, "They sound pretty good." And I said to Jack, "What do you mean they sound pretty good?" And he went on to tell me that the disease of alcoholism has a sound to it, and that's how he defends himself. He said, "Mr. Myers, I can put one foot in the house and determine the condition of the home immediately by the sound. And there's either too much noise, or there's no noise at all, or there's yelling, or profanity, or sarcasm, or flesh hitting flesh, or furniture hitting furniture. And depending upon what I hear, that's how I defend myself. And when I hear the wrong sound, I go to my room and maybe turn the lights down and the stereo up. Or maybe I try to get on the phone and call somebody that I think might understand. But if the pain is just too great, I go back out on the street because there's less pain on the street than there is the alcoholic home." And then Jack said something to me that was very profound and has been very important to the recovery for both Sally and myself in sobriety. Jack said to me, "If the sound of your house is the same today as it was a year ago, chances are you're not growing." I don't know how many Alateens come up to me and say, "You know, my dad was profane and rough when he was drinking. He's 3 years sober and he's still profane. When's he going to grow?" Or, "My mother was always late and inconsiderate when she was drinking. She's 4 years in the program and she's still late and inconsiderate. When's she going to grow?" And there were sounds in our marriage and in our relationship in sobriety that were very painful that Sally and I had to take out. I had to take the harshness out and the profanity out. Corey, our grandson, called me a couple years ago and he said, "Grandpa, I love to come to your house better than all the houses that I go to anywhere." And I said, "Why is that, Corey?" And he said, "Because it's quiet." Now, there's some interesting things that happen in sobriety. On a Friday night in sobriety, I would come home and I would say to Sally, "How would you like to go out for dinner?" And she'd say, "Great." And we would get in the car and we would start down Central Expressway in Dallas. And I would say to Sally, "Where would you like to go for dinner?" And she would say, "I don't care." And I would say, "Let's go to the Split Rail and get some barbecue." And she would say, "I don't feel like barbecue." I said, "Let's go to Vincent's and get some fish." She said, "I don't feel like fish." Now, we alcoholics are sensitive. And we don't handle rejection well. And it would be just a matter of minutes before we were fighting. And we've taken that, you know. Now, Bill Sears shouldn't get you in any trouble at all. Happens to be her brother. And whenever I would say Bill Sears, she would defend him and I would start to tear him down. And in about 10 minutes' time, I would go out the front door saying, "And he's still the dumbest turkey I ever met." And I had not been in the program very long, and one evening I said, "Bill Sears." And right on cue, the fight started, and 10 minutes later, I'm going out the door saying, "He's the dumbest turkey I ever met." And I remember having read in the big book that resentment is the number one offender, and it kills more alcoholics than anything. And I'm thinking, man, and I'm driving down, and I better get to my sponsor's house. And I drove over to Shep's house, and I rapped on the door, and I said, "Shep, you're not going to believe this." But I said, "By God, every time I say Bill Sears, the fight starts." And just 10 minutes later, I go out the door, and he'd let me rant and rave for a while. Finally, Shep said to me, "Didn't you have a drinking problem?" I said, "God, yes." He said, "What'd you do about that?" I said, "I don't drink anymore." Well, he said, "It would seem to me I wouldn't say Bill Sears." Oh, God. You know, Sean was talking about it earlier today in the workshop, the nuts and bolts of sobriety. You know, which I think for the most part, alcoholics just wanted to be, I just wanted to be a nice person and not get in trouble. And I thought to be a nice person, you had to wear nice clothes and drive a nice car and have a nice wife and have a nice house and have a nice job and you'd be a nice person. And when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, "If you want to be a nice person, be a nice person." I said, "Oh, God, I never thought about that." It's an incredible thing. I got my arms around Sally that morning in Westport and we took her to a psychiatrist. We always took her to a psychiatrist. We took her to five psychiatrists. And somehow alcoholics can do that. We can convince you that if we can get you fixed, we won't drink so much. And what this psychiatrist basically told Sally and I was that you're Iowa farm kids, and you're out of your element. And if you get out of this New England area and you get back to Iowa and get surrounded by family, and don't travel too much and get the monetary situation straightened out, I remember his exact words. He said, that thing will go away. And I remember we wrote all that down. You know, everything he told us, we wrote it down like the blueprints of a house. And we got back in the car and we drove towards Iowa. Now, the interesting thing about it was Sally and I knew about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her father came in the program in 1952, and he had 25 years of sobriety before he passed away, some 12 or 13 years ago. We loved what it had done for him. We loved what it had done for the family. And yet somehow we didn't see it for us. As a matter of fact, when I finally made it in 1973, I asked Dad, I said, Dad, my God, why didn't you talk to me about my drinking? I took all the things that you loved the most in this life and you never said a word to me. You know, I took your daughter and I took your love and I took your money and I took your booze. And not once did you ever talk to me about my drinking. And I remember he turned to me and he said, you would have resented it so much coming from me that it would have ruined the opportunity for the right person to reach you. And then he said something that I've heard many times in the program since then, that God made us all different, so we need each other. If he made us all the same, one of us wouldn't be necessary. And more than that, God has gifted each one of us with the ability to touch one other human being that nobody else can touch. And I'm willing to bet that everybody is sitting in this room tonight because at the right time, the right person had the ability to reach in and grab you by the heart and say, I've got a way out. I became pretty much of a periodic drunk when we got back to Iowa. And I really don't understand that. There were days when I would get dressed about like I am now and I would go to work and we'd have two or three martinis for lunch and somebody would say, let's go to Chicago. And I'd say, sounds good to me. And, you know, 3 or 4 days later, people would say to me, why did you do that? And I always had, I could give them a lot of dialogue, but I never answered the question. But I'll tell you what, if you do that often enough, strange people will gather in your living room. And I did that one too many times, and they were there. And you know who they are. It's usually the next-door neighbor and the minister and the attorney and the physician. I mean, when you walk in the room, there isn't any question about it. They're there for you. And on this particular morning when I came back, they pointed to me and they said, you need to go to the Alcohol and Psychiatric Clinic at the University of Iowa. And one thing about alcoholics, when you get us cornered and the evidence is so tangible that you just can't wiggle anymore, you begin to say funny things like, okay. And on a Monday morning, I'm sitting across from a psychiatrist in the Alcohol and Psychiatric Clinic at the University of Iowa, a man that Sally and I had known socially, and John was talking to me, and he was saying, Albert, when you drink, you get in a lot of trouble anymore. And I said, that's true, John. And he said, when you drink anymore, you hurt people. And I said, that too. And he said, let me tell you a little something about alcohol. There are people that are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. Your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain. And I remember saying to John, my God, John, I'm allergic to alcohol. He said, that's correct. And he said, I suggest that you talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you go to an AA meeting. And I want to say in September of 1967, Sally and I went to our first AA meeting. And a man that is now dead by the name of Gil Voss did exactly what it tells you to do in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, working with others. He told me about himself. And he showed me about the guilt and the shame and the degradation and the DWIs and the bankruptcies. And you know, as a matter of fact, that was a terrible story. I mean, I went home and told Sally, I said, my God, if I get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man much like Rick stood up and said, my name is, and I'm an alcoholic. And I turned to Sally and said, get me out of here. I am not like them. they gathered in the living room again, and and they said, we're going to take your house and we're going to sell it and we're going to keep the equity. And we're going to give you some furniture to live with, but we're going to auction off the furniture and we're going to keep the equity. And as I kind of stand here tonight and I look over and I see Sally, I can still visualize Sally and myself and the four children standing on the lawn. And the house is gone and the furniture is being auctioned off and we did not see the disease of alcoholism. You're dealing with a disease powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. And that's why a lot of us are in this room. The kids got to be 18 and they go off to college. And I think how wonderful the kids are going off to school. Hell, they never came back. I mean, once they got out of that alcoholic home, they stayed out of that alcoholic home. My daughter wrote me a letter one time and there was a passage in there that said, you'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same. And I remember reading that over and over again, thinking, my God, what have I done to destroy the relationship with my only daughter? And the oldest son got into drugs and kind of sold and jailed and trafficked and was married and divorced with child before he was 20, and another youngster in a relationship where there was no marriage. And I remember Sally and I were sitting down. We'd sit down in the quietness of the house and we'd try to figure out what was going on. And then the middle son, Tom, just left. You hear about the quiet child. And that's the way it was with Tom. There wasn't any dialogue. There wasn't any arguments. One morning I came to breakfast and he was gone. And I remember I used a friend. I had been fired from Owens Corning Fiberglass. And I used an executive friend that I had there to get a job in Shreveport, Louisiana. And in 1972, Sally and little John and myself drove to Shreveport. And if you heard Sally this morning, it was a very bad and difficult year, a year in which I drank around the clock. I would just get up in the morning and start drinking and try to get through the day and then try to get through the night so I could start again in the morning. And one night I was in a place called Shreve Square, and I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw these red lights going around about the color of her blouse down there, and I thought, whoops, man, I've heard about Louisiana Caddo Parish police deputies, and they're mean. And I'll be real careful when they pull me over. And I remember once again, I was so drunk, I could hardly get the car parked. And these two Caddo Parish police deputies came around to the left side of the car. And I rolled the window down and they said, could we have your driver's license? And I said, absolutely. And I just handed it to them out the window. And then I made a grave tactical error. I rolled the window up and drove off and left them standing there. Just have to take my word for it that that makes him mean. Okay? And the second time they got the car stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. Just the door flew open and they pulled the body out. And I remember they just kind of threw me up over the hood and the handcuffs are going up the back. And my alcoholic mind is saying, God, I hope nobody's watching this. You know, God. And they get me down to the jail cell on Texas Avenue there in Shreveport, Louisiana, and do the things that they need to do. And finally somebody said, we have to put you in a cell. And I said, terrific. And I remember they kind of swung me around and pushed me headfirst into this cell. And as I came back around, the bars were coming together. And then that sound that God created for drunks in jail. And for just one second, and I can't tell you why, I saw myself in my office in the glass building in New York overlooking Central Park to the jail cell in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I thought, man, you got a problem. Maybe. The guy said you can make a telephone call, and that really frightened me because people that had loved me for so long said, don't call, we don't care anymore. And I called a good customer, and he came down and got me out of jail. And God works in strange ways because Frank was not in the program. And I remember we got in the front seat of the car, and I told Frank, I said, let's get a six-pack and straighten this out. And he said, no. No, I said, why don't you spend the night at my house, and in the morning we'll try to figure out what to do with you. And God, he said that in such a degrading way, and I thought, what do you mean try to figure out what to do with me? I mean, I don't want to be the way I am. And I watched a big kitchen clock, and it got to be exactly 6 o'clock, and I called an Episcopal priest at Holy Cross Church, and I said, "Father Paul, this is Albert, and I'm in big trouble." And he said, "Can you get down to the church?" And I said, "Yes, I can." And we began to talk, and he said, "Albert, I want you to go to this halfway house. It's called the Bridge House in Stoner Avenue. And there's a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor down there that I think you can relate to." And I'm going, how in the hell could I relate to a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor in a halfway house? I mean, I'm kind of a high-class New York guy. But when you're cornered and the evidence is tangible, you begin to say funny things like, okay. You know, I think it's Hal M. that says, some get here because they see the light. Others get here because they feel the heat. And the heat was on that morning, and I was saying funny things. And at exactly 10:30, I walked to this halfway house. And there was a long table, just like you see in any AA club. And they sat me down in the end, and there were three Bills there that morning. Bill Seffel, Bill Steedley, and Bill Smith. They're all dead now. And, of course, Bill Wilson's picture was on the wall, so it was a real fuzzy morning. And one of those old guys said to me, "When did you have your last drink?" And I remember that I began to cry, and I started to pound on the table, and I said, I had my last drink last night, and I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks, and I got this DWI, and the house is gone, and the furniture's gone, and three of the four kids are left, and Sally wants to leave, and they're trying to pick up the car, and I'm about to get fired." And one of those old turkeys turned to the other one and said, "Boy, he sure sounds like one of us." The next guy said, "Would you do anything to get sober?" I said, "God, I'll do anything." And then the next guy chimed in and said, "Would you go to 7 meetings in a row?" 7 meetings in a row? God, I swung around and saw those dippy slogans, and I thought, my God, they're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I straightened up from this chair, and this marvelous old Louisiana man put his arm around me, and he said, "Albert, we need to go for a ride." And he put me in the front seat of his car, and we started towards Shumpert Hospital. And he said, "We're going to Shumpert Hospital. I have a friend over there in the alcoholic ward, and I also want you to meet this nun, Sister Germaine." And I thought, man, he's just checking me in. And on the way over, this old guy set the hook in me. He said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking." And that's all he said. He didn't say any more. He didn't say any less. And I started thinking about that. And the priest is right. I can relate to this guy. And I don't know how he's doing that, but I love it, you know. And we got over to the hospital, and we visited with his friend, and I met Sister Germaine. And on the way back to the halfway house, he set the hook in me one more time. And he said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. As a matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow." And I took the bait, and I said, "Bill, how long have you been doing that?" He said, "What's that, Albert?" I said, "That not quit drinking." He said, "27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow." Yeah. He said, "Albert, you need to know something. Nobody ever took my right to drink away from me. And I don't know what I thought you were going to take away from me." And I remember saying to Bill, "But my God, Bill, if those things work, you'll take away my freedom." And just this pathetic glaze came over his face, and he said, "Your freedom?" He said, "Let's talk a little bit about your freedom." He said, "Now, I have this dog that I put out in this backyard every day that's all fenced in." And he said, "That dog goes out there and it plays and it soaks up the sunshine and it barks at the birds." And he said, "I come home at night and I love it and pick it up and take it in the house." Now, he said, "I could let that dog be perfectly free and open up the back gate. And it could get out, maybe run over by a truck. Or maybe go without food and starve. Or maybe picked up by somebody that doesn't love it as much as I do and bring it in at night." He said, "It seems to me of the two freedoms, I would rather be the dog on the inside of the fence." And he said, "Albert, you can be as big and as free as you want as long as you stay on the inside of the fence of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and its principles." And I began to say funny things like, "Yes, sir." And he said, "You will come to that halfway house at 10:30 every morning." And I'm saying, "Yes, sir." And he said, you will not travel anymore. And I said, Bill, that's all I know. That's all I've ever done. He said, I don't care. You're not going to do that anymore. I said, what am I going to do? He said, you're going to sell used cars. I said, I've never sold used cars. He said, you're going to start. I said, yes, sir. And I remember I went to a man that I used to play golf with at the country club, and I asked Mr. Donaldson for a job. And he said, Albert, I don't have a job for selling cars, but he said, you can paint the offices for the first couple weeks. And I remember that Bill came by every single day. He and Ruth took Sally and I to our first 7 meetings. And Bill came by every single day, and he would roll down the window, and he'd say, you all right, Albert? And I'd say, I'm fine, Bill. And one day he came by, and he said, Albert, you've got to get a sponsor that you can relate to every day. And it scared me to death. I said, Bill, won't you be my sponsor? He said, I'll always be your sponsor. But he said, you need a sponsor that you can relate to every day. He said, there's a fellow that works for RCA, travels on the road and stays sober. I said, you're kidding. And he said, no, he said, I think he'd be a good sponsor for you. Did you ever notice who we turn our life over to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Bill Smith said to me, there's a guy by the name of Hoss Ross. And on a Thursday night at the Fairfield Group in Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm looking for a guy by the name of Hoss Ross. And I said to a couple of the guys, when Hoss shows up, point him out. And it wasn't long, the goofiest looking guy you ever saw in your life. About 6'5", weighed 135 pounds, and he dressed all in one color, all blue, all green. And he came through the side door, and he said, that's Hoss. And I went over to Hoss. I said, you Hoss Ross? He said, that's right, son. I said, you travel on the road for RCA and stay sober? He said, that's right, son. I said, Bill Smith says you'd be a good sponsor for me. Would you be my sponsor? He said, I'd be honored, son. He said, you have one of those big books? I said, not of my own. He said, you do now. And he bought me one that night, and he wrote into it, A Long Life in the Fellowship, Hoss Ross. He said, you belong anywhere? And I said, no. He said, you do now. And I signed a card that night to the group. And I want to tell you, Hoss called me every single day. Drove me crazy. He would call and say, what are you doing, son? I'd say, nothing. He'd say, I'll be right over. Went on for about 2 weeks. I told Sally, I said, God, I've made a terrible mistake. I can't shake him. You know? He called one night. He said, what are you doing, son? I said, Hoss, I'm busy tonight. He said, good, I'll do it with you. And I want to tell you that Hoss told me things that I thought no man would ever tell another man. And Hoss taught me honesty, and Hoss taught me courage, and Sally and I drove to Dallas, Texas on December the 13th of 1973, and we didn't know a soul, and we had little John. And I was driving a car that had been co-signed by my sponsor, and I was going to a job that had been arranged by my sponsor. And the money that I had in my pocket for the first month's rent and to buy groceries had been lent to me by my sponsor. And sometimes I forget that the clothes that I wear, the love for my family, the job that I have, the car that I drive, the money in my pocket, comes from exactly the same source as my sobriety. And I forget sometimes to give, because the program taught me to be a taker. I mean, the illness taught me to be a taker, and the program has taught me to be a giver. And there is a third dimension of receiving that I just haven't figured out yet. But I'm here tonight because of the Bill Smiths and the Hoss Rosses and the other old-timers that stood up in this room, because, you know, when we read tonight, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That path that is nothing more than the experience of the old-timers that have gone in front of us and cleared a way for us to walk. Little John had so much hate for my sobriety in the beginning that he used to keep a loaded shotgun in the bedroom for both Sally and I, and a hunting knife. And when we would go in to say hello to John, he would grab the shotgun, and we had to send him back to Shreveport and live with a family for 6 months so Sally and I could get started. And we got very busy in the program of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And we'd been in the program about 2 years, and I remember one weekend Sally and I were looking at houses. That's what alcoholics do that don't have any money on weekends. We look at houses. You know, we're just trying to kill a weekend. And I remember this lady was showing us this townhouse, and she said it's only $50,000 and 5% down and 8 3/4% interest, a 30-year loan. And she said you'd have no problems with that. And Sally and I giggled because I had tried to cash a check for $25 a day before, and somebody wanted a major credit card, and I didn't have a major credit card. But I called my sponsor that night, and I said, "Bill, you'll never guess what Sally and I were doing today." And he said, "What's that, Albert?" I said, "We were looking at houses." And he said, "Tell me a little bit about that." And I talked for a little while, and then Bill said to me, "Would you like to buy that house?" And I said, "Well, of course I'd like to buy that house." He said, "Well, you haven't forgotten about honesty yet, have you?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." He said, "Well, why don't you write a letter?" I said, "To who?" He said, "The loan committee that lady was talking about. Did you ever notice how we alcoholics are scared to death of losing something we don't own anyway?" And he said, "I'll tell you what you do." He said, "You write down there your name is, and you work here, and this is your area of responsibility, and this is what you make. And you're a very active member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous Alpha Club, Dallas, Texas. Sally works for this group of doctors. This is her area of responsibility. This is what she makes. She's a very active member of the Al-Anon Family Group, Alpha, Dallas, Texas." And I want to tell you, on a Monday morning, Sally and I drove up in front of a little place called Oak Cliff Savings and Loan. And before we went in, we held hands in the front seat of the car, and Sally and I said out loud together, "God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always." And there was a quietness and there was a strength in the front seat of the car that day that Sally and I had not felt for a long time. And we went in and we sat down in front of this little loan officer. And if you want to get a funny look on a loan officer's face, tell him you're there for $50,000 and you don't have any money or you don't have any credit. I mean, we got down to this part where it says money and credit, and I said, "We don't have any money and we don't have any credit." What I really wanted to say was my sponsor said, you know. But what Sally and I did do that morning is we gave them this letter, and basically we said, "This is where we are in the recovery of our life and where we are in our community. You give this to the loan committee and let them determine whether we should have the house or not." And I want to say it was 3 or 4 weeks they called and said, "Come get your $50,000. Now, I want to tell you, I'm privileged to sponsor a lot of people that come to me and say, "I can't get a house," or "I can't get a boat," or "I don't have any credit," or "I want to buy this land." And I'll say, "Hey, write a letter." They say, "It won't work." I say, "I know, but write it anyway." You know, and it's amazing to me what honesty will do for us out there. We were talking about it earlier today, that there is a way of living and a way of life for us that if we stay within the principles and the structure of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, strange things will happen to you. Sally and I were privileged to chair a meeting one night, and a man came in, obviously very troubled. And Sally, out of courtesy, said, "Is there anything anybody would like to talk about?" And God, this guy's arm just shot up, and he said, "I'd like to talk about something." He said, "I just got out of this treatment center, and I got this crazy wife and these 4 kids, and, you know, for about an hour, we tried to get a net over him, and you know how we are." And at the tail end of the meeting, I went over, and I said, "My name's Albert." "My name's Jim." I said, "What do you do, Jim?" He said, "I'm regional manager for Owens Corning Fiberglass." I said, "Oh, God." And we began to talk, and I became his sponsor, and I became his friend. And then after a couple of years, Jim said to me one day, "Why don't you come back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass?" And I said, "Oh, God, Jim, you don't understand. Up there in my file, there is a card that says, don't ever let this be all about." And he said, "No, we've changed our position on that. We have a very active employees assistance program, and of the 24,000 employees in Owens Corning Fiberglass, over 2,000 of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you write a letter?" So I did, and I knew who to write, and I said, "Dear guy, Jim and I are talking about this. If there would be any possibility," it was just a short period of time they called and said, "We'll send your resume back," and I knew they had one. So I just gave him an AA resume, September 6th, driving while intoxicated, jail, Shreveport Jail, sold used cars, 2 miles. I just went through the whole thing and sent it back up there. And they called me up for interviews, and it was so funny because large corporations have a have a professional interviewer, if you will. I had to go through 5 interviews that day. But the very first one, this man was supposed to ask me 30 mandatory questions. And he sat me down, and all of a sudden his face just began to smile a little bit. And he said, "You know, I can't ask you these 30 questions." But he said, "I've been dying to meet you." He said, "You know, of all the years with Owens Corning Fiberglass, I've never seen a resume where a guy starts out in jail." And you know, an interesting thing, the fear that had plagued me all of my life was gone. I knew who I was and what I was, and he knew who I was and what I was. And the 5th interview that day was with a man that had been my branch manager in Kansas City some 15 years prior. And the interview went like this. "How's Sally and the kids?" I said, "Terrific, Dick. How's Marion and your kids?" He said, "Super." He said, "Are you ready to come back to work?" And I said, "You bet." And they bridged some 15 years, and they took me back with Owens Corning Fiberglass. And I'd been with them about a year, and one night I was playing racquetball, and I had a heart attack. And I didn't know that I had the attack because I didn't have the customary pain that goes with heart problems. And it just felt like I had a little pull in my back, and the following day it began to nag. And later on that evening, Sally took me to the hospital, and I said, "Hey, would you take a look at my back?" And in just a short period of time, they said, "We hate to tell you, but you've shut down the whole right coronary area." And if you know anything about intensive care heart units, they're very fussy. And they took me on this gurney, and they took me up to intensive care heart units. And, of course, I'm monitored. And you see these little plaques on the wall that say, "Family only, 2 people only, 2-minute limit, visit only." And Sally and one of the sons had just been visiting with me. And I remember I was wired up, and I was coming in and out of the oxygen. And as I came to the second time, this black guy that I sponsor was standing at the end of my bed. And I said to Bob, I said, "Bob, how the hell did you get in here?" He said, "I told him I was family." I said, "What the hell else did you tell him?" He said, "I told him you were my father." We have a remarkable fellowship, I'll tell you. I had a second heart attack with no pain in a cardiovascular class, and I remember the cardiologist says, "You have a real problem. You can't monitor your disease." And I said, "Yeah, that happened to me once before." So they said, "We're going to do an angiogram," and they did. And I remember they said, "Hey, you're going to need a triple bypass." Alcoholics are wonderful, because I remember right to the end I said to the surgeon, "What happens if I don't have the triple bypass?" He said, "You'll die." I said, "Oh, okay, I understand that." You know, I don't advocate open heart surgery for an in-depth third step, but I'll tell you this. The night before open heart surgery, you will do an in-depth third step. You will do an in-depth 7th step. You will do every step. But the remarkable thing about that was I had a program, and I had the principles, and I had your love, and I had your strength, and there was a sense of I didn't have to do it alone for both Sally and myself, and I'll be forever grateful. The daughter who wrote me the letter was having problems 5-6 years ago, and she called and said, "Daddy, could I come to Texas with the grandson?" And I said, "Sure, honey, when are you coming?" And she told me, and I said, "You better pick another date, because Mother's going to be up in Oklahoma to a woman-to-woman conference." And she said, "No, Dad, I think I'd like to come down and be with you." And understand, I'm a father that's plagued with a tremendous amount of guilt where his children are concerned. And I'm a very tangible alcoholic. And my amends go something like this. "God, Roxy, I am so sorry for the things that I did. And I feel so badly about the promises that I made and never kept. And God willing, it will never happen again. And would you like a color television set?" "I really want you to know that I'm sorry." And whenever we go shopping, Roxy is very careful not to point, because she knows that my guilt will say, "Let's go get it." But we went shopping, and we were walking around this very fussy mall in Dallas, and I said to her, "I see where George Shearing and Mel Torme are playing down at the Fairmont tonight. How would you like an evening on the town with your dad?" And she said, "I would love that." And we made arrangements for a sitter, and we got all gussied up and fussied up, and we went down to this fancy hotel, and the maitre d' took us to our table, and the music began to play, and I said to Roxy, would you like to dance? And I remember I'm kind of holding my girl, and we're dancing, and she all of a sudden says, Daddy, I just love you so much. You are the greatest father in all the world. You mean so much to me. And I can't begin to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to me that night. The tongue is a poor instrument in the affairs of the heart. And I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a good father or to be a good husband or to be a good anything. I came here to get the heat off and the pain out. And you gave me a set of principles that overpowered my personality, that makes me a functioning human being to my family and to my friends and to my community, and I will be forever grateful. And I have a relationship with my girl today that I would not have known how to pray for. The oldest son that got into the drugs and trafficked and had a great problem in the structure of society. You know, if we cripple our children in the home with the disease of alcoholism, we have no right to be startled when they limp and struggle in society. And somehow Chuck continued to get into jail. And I remember they called one time from Austin and they said he was in jail on 2 counts of criminal mischief. And the bail had been set and the attorney's fees were $2,000. And I remember writing the check for $2,000. I'm 12 years in sobriety and I'm writing a check for $2,000. And up here in my mind says it's going to be different this time. And yet, way down deep, I had enough of the program to know that I was killing my son while I was writing the check. Yet I wrote the check and I sent it. And it was just a few months after that they called back and he was back in jail again on criminal harassment. And the bail had been raised and the attorney's fees had gone up and we were talking back and forth. And I can't tell you how I did it or why I did it. But I said, Chuck, man, I love you like a rainbow, but I'm not playing anymore. And I don't know how you got in, and I don't know how you're going to get out, but I'm done. And I remember I put the phone down. I didn't slam it. I just set it down. And I want to tell you, my heart was broken. And I've heard the Al-Anons talk about frozen emotions, and I couldn't think of anybody to call. Nothing worked. I couldn't even think of my sponsor. And I called an Al-Anon, and I said, hey, I've just said no to my son for the first time in 12 years, and my heart is broken. And she said, of course it is. You're a father, but you got to work the steps. I said, damn it, I know the steps. And she said, yeah, but you ain't working them. I said, for God's sakes, help me. And she said, well, say out loud you're powerless over your son. Thank you. And that he makes your life unmanageable. And I'm kind of standing here, and I've got the phone like this, and I'm going, I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. And I want to tell you, that's the way that was. I was powerless over Chuck, and he made my life unmanageable. And then she said, a power greater than yourself is going to restore him to sanity. And if God restores him to sanity and restores me to sanity, thank you, I don't have that problem. And then she said, you got to turn his will and his life over to the care of God. And if I turn his will over and his life over, and I turn my will over and I turn my life over, I don't have that problem. And then she said, I want you to write down a few things that make you feel guilty about your son. And I didn't even hesitate. Man, I just wrote down there, made him do things that he didn't want to do when he was small. I mean, my foot was in the middle of his back when the sun was shining, and you will play competitive sports. You'll play football, baseball, basketball, Pop Warner, police athletic, whatever it is, because it's a competitive world out there, and one of these days you're going to love me for it. You know, the fact that God had gifted him as an artist and a poet and a journalist didn't do anything for me. I used to get him by the shoulders and I'd shove him up against the wall and his eyeballs would get about that big and I'd say, damn you. You know, if you just get your hair cut, just get to school on time, just pick up your room, do what I tell you to do, you can be just like me. And God, he used to look out, you know. One time he looked me in the eye and he said, Dad, you're insane. And I said, how dare you talk to me like that? By God, I put the clothes on your back and the food on the table and the roof over your head. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have what you have. And I didn't know how true that was. And I left him in jail that day with the help of an Al-Anon who put my heart back together. And I want to say that a year went by and I went down to Austin to see Chuck and another year went by and he came up to see me. And not this last Father's Day, but the one before. you sent me a great big card. And it was a big card, and on the front of it was a great big monkey all dressed up like Humphrey Bogart, you know, the trench coat and the hat and the cigarette. And when you opened it up, the caption on the inside was, "Here's looking at you, Dad." And then down below it had, "P.S. I just want to tell you how proud I am of what you've done with your life. You've certainly given me something to live up to." And I played golf with Chuck, I guess, 3-4 weeks ago, and I have a relationship with my oldest son that I would not have known how to pray for. The middle son, who's getting married in November, when he first got engaged to his lady, called Sally and I said, you know, and he said, "I want you and Mom to be the first to meet my lady." And then little John, God, little John. Little John is now 31 years old. First had my sobriety, he kept a loaded shotgun and a hunting knife for Sally and I. Had to live with another family. They kind of agreed if he would leave high school, they'd give him a diploma. He's one of those kids that's never come to a meeting. He's never been to an AA, Al-Anon, open anything. But he's got the principles of the program because we're attractive. We don't promote to him, but we're attractive, and he likes what he sees. He likes what he sees in his mother and in his dad. And he likes what he sees in the fellowship that we're a part of. And John somehow got involved in ladies' sportswear and with Jones of New York and Christian Dior, and somehow just kept working and watching and working and watching. And a couple years ago, his company sent him to Hong Kong as part of the manufacturing and designing team. And Sally and I thought, how wonderful, we're going to go to Hong Kong and see little John. And before we could get over there, they made him executive vice president and general manager of his company. And you know, Sally and I talk about that because what I see is this kid that was crippled by the disease of alcoholism, that took the physical abuse in our home, who somehow has the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in his living structure, to the extent that he just hired one of us for his sales staff in New York about 2 weeks ago. And he said to this girl who was applying for the job, "How do you know my mother and father?" And she said, "Because I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he hired her. I heard Sean talk today about a love-hate relationship with the mother and father, which happens pretty frequently. And I have an 84-year-old mom that lives out in Santa Cruz, California, still runs around with a little T-shirt and sneakers, says, "I survived the earthquake." And I'm an only child, and I've had kind of a love-hate relationship for my mom because I'm the son that never really, you know, I never lived up to what I thought my mother wanted me to be. And last year, I was privileged to speak in Fresno, California, and so Sally and I called. I said, "Mom, I'm going to be in Fresno, California. How would you like to go to an AA conference?" She's another one, never been to a meeting of any kind, a la cat, a la dog, a la anything. And she said, I think I'd like that. So Sally and I flew to San Francisco, and we drove down to Santa Cruz, and we picked up my little 83-year-old mom then. And on a Saturday night in Fresno, California, I introduced her to 3,000 drunks. And I don't have to tell you what you did. You know, you do what you always do. God, you stood, and you clapped, and you loved, and you hugged. And you told her about her boy. Hell, she thinks I'm president of this thing. And a son that could not live up to her expectations in his own mind. I think my mom's selling tapes on the side. She'll say, "You got any tapes?" You know. She called last week. She said, "Where are you going this week?" I said, "Helena, Montana." She said, "Now, don't you embarrass us." I said, "I won't, Mom, you know." It's nice to have a love affair going with your lady after 42 years. I think sometimes we are graced with two love affairs with the same lady. You know, we had a chance to build a marriage in society and personalities. But 17 years ago, we had the privilege of putting a relationship and a marriage together with the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And chronologically, we've been together for a long time. 42 years is quite a few years. But I'll tell you this, on a daily basis, we're still learning how to touch and how to feel and not how to be afraid of each other. This marvelous old Louisiana man, when I first came into the program, the very first week said, "You will date your wife every Friday." And I said, "You old fool, we've been married for 25 years. And he said, "You don't understand. The alcoholism has destroyed your senses, and you're going to have to learn how to love and feel all over again." And it's been a wonderful thing to put a love affair together in the program and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. My having a good love affair with my lady doesn't have anything to do with my lady. It has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. When my behavior is funny, my love affair is funny. I have never lost anything because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you were to tell me to write down anything that I lost because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not scratch the paper. I have never lost anything because I have said my name is Albert Myers and I'm an alcoholic. If you were to ask me what I lost before I got here, you would have to invite me back for another conference. I know if Sally could come up here. I know if the children could come up here. If the grandchildren could come up here. They would all tell you what I'm about to tell you. We are in gratitude that you have given us our life back. We love you. We're privileged to be in your presence. And thank you so much for having Sally and I. Good night.